for every Israeli killed, 100 Palestinians were killed. For every Israeli civilian killed, about 400 Palestinian civilians were killed. That's plainly not a war. That's a massacre.
Norman Finkelstein received his doctorate from the Department of Politics at Princeton University in 1988 and taught classes on political theory and the Israel-Palestine conflict for many years. He is the author of numerous books on the conflict, including Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict and Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. He is also the subject of the documentary American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. The following speech was given at the 8th Annual Convention of Al-Auda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition. Finkelstein spoke on the subject of his latest book, entitled This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion.
The topic for my remarks this evening is what happened in Gaza about a year and a half ago now. And that in itself is a kind of curiosity, because as everybody in this room knows, wars come and go with great frequency and rapidity in the Middle East, and barely a few months elapse before they disappear from the public consciousness. And yet something peculiar happened with Gaza, because it's nearly a year and a half since the Israeli invasion of Gaza, and yet it remains as current as ever. In fact, it almost seems as if it happened at most a month or two ago. And so one of the questions which is worth trying to ponder this evening is, why does Gaza endure? Why is it this ghost, Gaza, that try as Israel does, it can't seem to bury? Why is it that this shadow follows Israel wherever it goes? As Professor Ghanem said in his introductory remarks, even now, a year and a half later, Israeli officials feel very insecure, because wherever airport they depart from, they're fearful that papers will be served, and the papers will be served because of what they did in Gaza. And so why is that? Why does Gaza live so long after what Israel inflicted during those 22 days that Amnesty International called the 22 days of death and destruction? I want to begin, however, with some of the background to how we got to those 22 days. It's always a little bit arbitrary, where do you begin? The Goldstone Report, to which I'll return later, it more or less begins with the ceasefire that Israel signed with Hamas in June 2008. I will go a little bit further back. In January 2006, there were parliamentary elections in the occupied Palestinian territories, and Hamas, the Islamic movement, emerged victorious. The elections, according to the former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was one of the international observers, he said the elections were completely honest and fair. In reaction to these completely honest and fair elections, Israel, backed by the United States and then the European Union, it imposed economic sanctions on Hamas and on the Palestinian people living in Gaza. In June 2007, the United States, Israel, and some elements among the Palestinian Authority attempted a coup to overthrow the legally elected government. In the United States, that's called democracy promotion. Hamas foiled the coup, and it sent the Palestinian elements packing to the West Bank. In reaction to the foiled coup attempt, Israel, backed by the United States, it tightened the blockade on Gaza, a blockade which Amnesty International now called a flagrant violation of international law, a blockade which the Goldstone Mission later called a possible crime against humanity. The former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, she journeyed to Gaza during these months. And she said, and now I'm quoting her, "Gaza's whole civilization has been destroyed." I'm not exaggerating. Its whole civilization has been destroyed. In June 2008, Israel and Hamas entered into a ceasefire that was brokered by the Egyptian government. And under the ceasefire, each side had obligations. On the Palestinian side, they were obliged to cease their rocket and mortar attacks on Israel. On the Israeli side, they were obliged to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza, the blockade which was a flagrant violation of international law, the blockade which was destroying a civilization. According to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and now I'm quoting it, Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. There were some, to use the Israeli terminology, rogue terrorist organizations, not Hamas, but using the Israeli terminology, rogue terrorist organizations, which were not observing the ceasefire. According to the Israelis, and now I'm quoting them again, Hamas enforced the ceasefire on the rogue terrorist organizations with a great deal, although not complete success. So on one side, Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Israel, however, reneged on its obligation to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza, the blockade which was a flagrant violation of international law. Well, what happened next? Here the evidence is perfectly clear. All one has to do is turn to the Amnesty International yearbook for 2008. And Amnesty writes, "A ceasefire agreed in June between Israel and Palestinian armed groups in Gaza, it held for 4.5 months. But it broke down after Israeli forces killed 6 Palestinian militants in airstrikes and other attacks on 4 November. The ceasefire was holding, even though Israel had reneged on its obligations. And then Israel patiently waited until election day in the United States, the historic election where the media and the public were riveted to the results. And on that day, Israel invaded Gaza, killed 6 Palestinian militants, knowing full well that at that point, the ceasefire would break down, which is what happened. But you know those Islamicists, those fanatics and lunatics and cowards, You can never predict what they'll do next. And so what did Hamas do? Hamas kept saying, until the end of December, we're willing to renew the ceasefire. We're ready to renew the ceasefire. But Israel has to live up to its obligation. It has to lift the blockade. The blockade, which is a flagrant violation of international law. Israel said no. Hamas had to unconditionally and unilaterally cease its rocket attacks on Israel. By December, Sarah Roy of Harvard University, the world's leading authority on Gaza's economy, she also happens to be the daughter of survivors of Auschwitz concentration camp. Sarah Roy wrote, "The breakdown of an entire society is happening in front of us. It's happening in front of us in Gaza. But there is little international response beyond UN warnings, which are ignored. And now the people of Gaza, Hamas, was confronted with two stark options. One, it could acquiesce, succumb to its gradual starvation. Or the second option was to resist. Hamas chose to resist, although the resistance was largely symbolic. The former Israeli commander in Gaza, his name is Shmuel Zakai, the former Israeli commander in Gaza, he said, speaking to the Israelis, "You cannot just land blows, leave the Palestinians in Gaza in the economic distress they're in, and expect that Hamas will just sit around and do nothing." In the midst of the invasion, the Hamas leader, Khalid Meshaal, he said, "Our modest homemade rockets are our cry of protest to the world. Our modest homemade rockets are our cry of protest to the world." What were those rocket attacks, if not a message to an indifferent world? SOS, we're dying. SOS, we're dying. It's easy enough to condemn Hamas for the rocket attacks, but then, in my opinion, you have to show what was their other option. If you can't demonstrate that they had another option, but you're telling them to not fire the rockets, you're in effect saying that the people of Gaza had a legal and moral obligation to just lie still and die. In any event, on December 27, 2008, Israel invaded Gaza. And 22 days later, the attack, or the formal attack, ended. What happened in Gaza during those 22 days? Nowadays, when you read reports on what happened in Gaza, even by sympathetic sources, a recent report that came out by Human Rights Watch, a report that I was just reading on the plane over from what's called the International Crisis Group, they all refer uniformly, they refer to the Gaza War. The war in Gaza. Israel, in order to justify the death and destruction in Gaza, it keeps saying that it was confronted in Gaza with what it calls an asymmetrical war, that it fought with Hamas terrorists. And then they say, well, yes, there might have been death and destruction, but we all know that in the course of war, A lot of things, terrible things happen. It's just the nature of war. That you have to make split-second decisions. That there's confusion in the battlefield. What they call the technical term, they refer to it as the fog of war. That everything is a little bit misty, so you don't know quite what's going on. So call it an asymmetrical war. Call it the fog of war. Call it, as I said earlier, the Gaza war. They all start from the assumption, the premise, that there was a war in Gaza. But was there a war in Gaza? After those 22 days, the Israelis were very proud of themselves. They went around saying, we've now shown the Arabs who's who and what's what. Because in July, August 2006, they suffered a major defeat in Lebanon. And after that defeat, they began to worry that what they call their deterrence capacity was diminished. Deterrence capacity is one of those fancy technical terms that political scientists invent in order to make you believe that they know something that you don't, and most of the time they don't. All it means is the Arab world's fear of Israel. That's the deterrence capacity. And Israel was worried that after what happened July, August 2006 in Lebanon, that the Arabs no longer feared Israel. There was this character named Sheikh Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, and he's given to speechifying, and he was giving all these speeches, and he was going around saying, the Arabs are no longer afraid of Israel. And he was taunting the Israelis and saying, come on, attack again. If you attack again, we'll defeat you again. And this was very troubling to the Israelis. But after Gaza, they went around boasting, well, now we have shown the Arabs that we're still a fighting force. We have erased the memory of the Lebanon war because we won the war in Gaza. We won the war in Gaza. But along came an Israeli strategic analyst, and he wrote, it is very dangerous for Israel to believe it won the war when there was no war. In reality, not a single battle was fought during the 22 days. A former Israeli foreign ministry official, he said, there was no war. Hamas sat in its bunkers and came out when it was all over. So what did happen in Gaza? I noticed a few people with perplexed looks in their eyes in the audience. What did happen in Gaza? We have a fairly clear picture of what happened on the so-called battlefield. Israel began the attack with the air assault on Gaza. And by the end of the 22 days, they had launched 3,000 combat missions over Gaza. Every plane returned. None was downed. None was even harmed, damaged. That's not too surprising, because the Palestinians had no anti-aircraft weapons to speak of. After the first week, Israel launched what it called its ground and air assault. The Israeli soldiers were equipped with special night fighting equipment. Hamas couldn't even see them, let alone fight them. So what happened in Gaza? In fact, we have a pretty good picture because after those 22 days, many Israeli soldiers publicly testified to their experience in Gaza. Here's what they had to say. Soldier, there was nothing there, ghost towns. Except for some livestock, nothing moved. Soldier, most of the time it was boring. There were really not too many events. Soldier, I did not see one single Arab the whole time we were there, that whole week. Soldier, everyone was disappointed about not engaging anyone. Soldier, usually we did not see a living soul, except for our soldiers, of course. Not a soul. Soldier, go ahead, ask the other soldiers how often they encountered combatants in Gaza. Nothing, no one. Soldier, there was supposed to be a tiny resistance force upon entry, but there just wasn't any. No battles, no enemy in the field, no tangling with a foe. That's only half the story. Soldier after soldier, although they were interviewed separately, soldier after soldier says, Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. No battles. No enemy in the field. No tangling with the foe. But Israel is using insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. One soldier after another testifies. One soldier said, this was firepower such as I had never known. There were blasts all the time. The earth was constantly shaking. Another soldier said, on the ground you hear these thunderous blasts all day long. The Israelis commandeered Palestinian homes in Gaza, were firing into the horizon, but the ground underneath them was shaking. It was shaking so much they were told to leave the houses they had commandeered for fear the houses would collapse on them. So what did happen in Gaza? Actually, the Israeli soldiers came up with the most telling metaphors. One soldier said, it felt like hunting season had begun. Sometimes it reminded me of a PlayStation computer game. Another soldier said, you felt like a child playing around with a magnifying glass, burning up ants. You felt like a child with a magnifying glass, burning up ants. I was a kid once. I had my magnifying glass. I'm not very proud of it. Focused the rays of the sun, turned the ants into crispy critters. But I was not so delusional, I don't think, as to believe I was engaged in a war with the ants. In fact, the metaphor, a child with a magnifying glass burning up ants, was remarkably accurate. Among Israel's tools of the trade is its promiscuous use of white phosphorus. White phosphorus, it reaches a temperature of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit, 816 degrees centigrade. 1500 degrees Fahrenheit. As Oprah would say, try wrapping your mind around that. So what did Israel do with the white phosphorus? Human Rights Watch, the respected human rights organization, put out a report after the Gaza invasion entitled Rain of Fire. And it said, and now I'm quoting it, Israel repeatedly exploded white phosphorus munitions in the air over populated areas, killing and injuring civilians and damaging civilian structures. Israel dropped the white phosphorus in a school. It dropped the white phosphorus on a market. It dropped the white phosphorus on a humanitarian aid warehouse. It dropped the white phosphorus on two hospitals. It dropped white phosphorus in Al-Quds Hospital, and it dropped white phosphorus on Al-Wafa Hospital. Human Rights Watch wrote that the hospitals were clearly marked, and there does not appear to have been fighting in that immediate area. By the end of those 22 days, 1,400 Palestinians had been killed, of whom up to four-fifths were civilians. About 358 were children. 13 Israelis were killed, of whom 10 were combatants, and half of the combatants were killed due to what's called friendly fire, namely Israeli soldiers accidentally killed other Israeli soldiers. So, for every Israeli killed, 100 Palestinians were killed. For every Israeli civilian killed, about 400 Palestinian civilians were killed. That's plainly not a war. That's a massacre. Every time anyone in this room uses the word war to refer back to what happened, you become wittingly or unwittingly, intentionally or not, you become an instrument of Israeli propaganda. There was no war in Gaza. There was a massacre in Gaza.